Hello, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and I'm coming to you from the south bank of the Thames River in London, just across the river from Parliament, where the British flag is still flying over a particularly chaotic week in British politics and, frankly, international affairs. Welcome to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend. We have teamed up with our partners at the BBC and their show In the Balance to look at some of the many angles of the Brexit. That's the UK's referendum vote to leave the European Union. Where I am, it's cloudy and a little windy, fairly typical British summer weather. You've got school groups around me and some tourists still. But all of this kind of belies how strange a week it has been here. There is a massive current of uncertainty. The majority of people voted to leave the EU, but now it's unclear what will happen. There's a big fight to leave the country, and all of this has huge effects on international trade, markets, and everyday lives in Europe, America, and around the world. We're digging into all of it this hour, so stay with us and share your thoughts on Marketplace's Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. I'm inside now at BBC Studios in New Broadcasting House for our first segment, Long and Short. One way we like to look at the news is through a lens we've borrowed from the world of finance, bringing on a couple of smart people and asking them to go long or short. That is, bet on or against topics in the news. So on this special show, we've got two of Marketplace's resident Brits, John Buckley and Patty Hirsch. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
All right. So usually we do this. We have someone pick a long position, someone pick a short position on different things. But we are using this lens to look at Brexit, the British economy, the world economy. So, John, you can go first. What are you long?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm long on Brexit, both for the European Union and for the UK.
So you think it's a good thing?
I think it could in the long term be a very good thing, yes.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, dear. It's the end
of
the world as we know it.
Go ahead, fight amongst yourselves.
No, I'm afraid I have to come out against John here. I mean, I'm long Brexit for journalism because this story is going to run and run and run. It's going to be one of the best things that has ever happened to journalism. Actually, the best thing that's happened to journalism since Donald Trump announcing his candidacy for the Republican Party.
It's reviving flailing media empires.
It's going to be great. But I actually think I'm short Brexit because I think it's going to be bad for Britain in the short term. You've already seen all sorts of problems with the currency. That's going to translate in the medium term to the markets. It's going to be bad for Europe because I think the withdrawal of the amount of money that the UK puts into Europe is going to put a real crimp on Europe's finances. I think you could see a currency crisis and a constitutional crisis in Europe in the medium term. And I think that in the end, in the long term, you could actually see the breakup of Europe as a bloc.
Well, if Patty's going there, John, I think I need you to explain your long position here on the Brexit, because it does sound a little disastrous. And while I've been here in London just over this past week, it's like, somebody's resigning every 20 minutes.
Absolutely. And I think, there may well be to some extent a crisis of leadership with the governing Conservative Party seeming in disarray, the opposition seeming in disarray, and many people not wanting in a way this job, this task of renegotiating the relationship with what will be the EU as a separate body. I can understand that. But I would say that falling currency, for the first point, a falling currency is not necessarily a bad thing. Of course, it's an immediate boost to tourism. A lot of businesses are going to find this a fillip. And, the fundamental questions that the Leave campaign raised, questions of accountability, questions of the ability to really control the numbers of people coming into the country. The questions of immigration, a central concern in many parts of the United Kingdom. Those concerns, the people have spoken on them, and I think that both the United Kingdom, which will get more control over its own affairs, and the EU, which is going to be forced to take a look at some of those tensions on things like democratic accountability, free movement of labour, excessive regulation, will benefit from this in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, John is right about the currency. I mean, as the currency drops, it's actually pretty good for the UK economy in the short term.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean,
if you're an exporter, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually the reason why the markets, the UK markets, are doing better than most of the other European markets. That's the reason for that. But I think that's a short term thing. In the medium term, I think it's not a good thing. I mean, nobody wants their currency to be depressed for too long. Of course, you don't want your currency to be, you don't want people running into your currency as a flight to quality either, because then that creates problems, which we're having in the US and the Japanese are having with the yen as well. So you want that kind of moderation. But I don't think we're going to get that moderation with the pound. I mean, there's talk from Citigroup and a number of other banks this week that you could see the pound drop level with the dollar in the next 6 months. And that would be a serious problem for the UK economy.
Let me ask you both this, though. Business runs on a lot of things, but chief among them is confidence, certainly if you think about the financial industry. So how do you have confidence if you are an international conglomerate looking to operate in the UK or Europe, or if you're a European business trying to figure out what the rules are when everything seems to be in such disarray?
Yeah, I mean, this is all the risk management business, right? But I think that any company worth its salt, if they want to make money, at some point they're going to have to get off the sideline. Of course, they're going to be sitting there for a while thinking, oh, yeah, how long is it going to take to sort this out? I mean, it could be 6 months to a year before we even get Article 50 brought to the table. That is, even if it even happens. If you're a business, you can't sit around for a year. You have to, at some point, make a decision if you want to make money, if you want to survive. But, you know, some businesses may stay on the sidelines for 3 years. I doubt it. Not if they're going to be successful businesses. I think what we're going to see is almost the institutionalization of uncertainty. Uncertainty is going to become the watchword for Europe and people investing in it. We don't know how it's going to shape out. Maybe we're going to have to hedge a little bit, but we're going to have to commit at some point in some way.
I'd like both of you to take a position then on, are you long or short the British economy?
In the long term, I am long on the British economy. And I think that the reason is that I think this single nation making its own decisions is going to be much more nimble, much less bureaucratic, and is going to get much more done in the interests of itself.
If long is a decade, then I'm long the British economy. But it's going to take a decade. I mean, we're going to see, it's going to be 10 years, I think, before the UK, you know, restores itself to its former glory. And even then, I don't think it would be as glorious economically as if it was still connected to the European Union. I think as a nation, well, that's a whole other thing. I mean, I'm actually short the United Kingdom because I think that the price of peace in Northern Ireland, now that in 3 years, if this happens, then there will be a shared border between the European Union and the United Kingdom in Ireland. And I think that's going to cause all sorts of ructions and problems. And I think the price of peace in Northern Ireland is going to be a united Ireland. And that's going to be the breakup of the United Kingdom.
Wow. John?
With reference to the United Kingdom, I think it's always been one of the most light-touch regulatory environments for international companies. Look at some of the problems that companies like Google have had, for instance, with the EU. And I think you might well find, in the longer term, a number of businesses choosing to do business in that environment rather than in the sort of bureaucratic morass that is the European Union.
I think that's a totally fair point. I mean, I've read a lot in the last couple of days about people who are looking at this and saying, you know, the UK is much more of an ideological ally when it comes to business practices with the United States than the European Union is. And I think it's going to be very attractive for American businesses and actually for Asian businesses as well, who tend to prefer a lighter regulatory touch than the EU will provide. And I think that the UK actually will look very attractive from that point of view. Is it going to be attractive enough? I don't know.
Guys, I hear you have a song. You want to give me a taste?
Just the first stanza, John.
Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall.
John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, thank you both very much.
It's our consummate pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thanks, Lizzie.
Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s. Bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, cos we're saying goodbye to them all.
From London, you're listening to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend in collaboration with our partners at the BBC. Since the Brexit vote, there have been reports of anti-immigrant incidents here in the UK, which have worried members of those communities living in Britain. The BBC's Dougie Shaw went to visit Elena Erebovanska this week. She's from Eastern Europe and runs a small chain of shops in Cambridgeshire, in the east of England, catering to the big Polish community there.
My name is Elena, and I'm originally came from Ukraine. I came to this country first time when I was 19 years old. I had 100 quid in a pocket, and I knew nobody. I was lucky to meet some people who were actually British and who were very kind and who supported me. I think what I have now is a lot to the kindness of people in UK. The idea of this shop is actually came from my husband. It was very risky. That time it was only one shop in Peterborough selling Eastern European food. Actually, we put all our savings towards this shop. We had to take a little bit of loan as well from the bank. Hard work, that's what made this success. At the moment, we have three shops. We were planning to open the fourth one, but with the situation, which is rising now, we decided to wait and see what's going to happen.
How surprised were you about the referendum results?
We didn't sleep that night. The television, the live referendum on TV was on all night, and it was shocking, really, because for us it was a day when the life went upside down. Even now it's so kind of, you know, like floating in the air, but take into account that they're going to be the borders, they're going to be customs now, that mean the cost of the items we tend to bring from the EU going to go up. Again, the pound value is not as good as it was before. And that's mean, again, as we are purchasing the products from the EU, that's going to hit the cost of the products again. So the prices will have to increase.
You're listening to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend in collaboration with our partners at the BBC. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Here in London, we're examining how the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union is unfolding. The Brexit has unearthed a lot here. Passion, fear, second thoughts, misinformation, and really wondering what it means to be a citizen. BBC correspondents fanned out around the UK where people were showing up to say what they think. Here's some of what they had to say.
You know, most people voted on the issue of immigration, but if they stop and think about it, there's, what, 68 million people living in here. It's only 0.5 of them are immigrants.
We're really here to say, first and foremost, people are welcome. We're a welcoming country. EU citizens are welcome, and they must have their rights guaranteed.
I'm here to demonstrate solidarity with the European idea. It's not good that the referendum was so narrow.
It's fine. It's good, because it's too many people in London from other countries.
Where are you from yourself?
I'm from Croatia.
So you're from another country?
Yes, of course, but we have papers for the work and everything. The other people don't have, and they work here illegally.
I think now an awful lot of the ones who voted for it regret their decision, and I think they made a decision based on lies. So I actually think the majority now in this country wouldn't want this.
At a very early age, I came to this country. There is one planet, one species, we are all in it. So at the end of the day, I think this decision was a tragedy.
Well, I'm from France. I've been living in this country for about 28 years, and I feel very, very upset, betrayed, very disappointed.
I was in shock. I'm not happy, mostly because of the economic impact of it, but try to look at the bright side of it.
I think there needs to be reconsideration of the decision to exit the EU and hopefully a better outcome for the British public.
I think what the referendum revealed was never expect a straight answer from a politician.
voters here in London and big cities overwhelmingly wanted to stay in the EU. But in the northwest of England, and really outside most metropolitan centres, voters wanted out. The industries they worked in have declined, and they say the country's elite haven't listened to them. I went to the town of St. Helens, not far from Liverpool. St. Helens is 2.5 hours by train from London, but it feels worlds away. It's quiet, brick buildings recall the British Empire, and there's a windy town square with a memorial to the dead from both world wars. And 58% of the people here voted out. And it doesn't take long, even just walking down the street, to find them.
Angela Whitley, I voted leave.
Tell me why.
If you go to the hospital, you're waiting a long time. There's no room for any more people to come in the country.
She was leaving a tea shop with her niece, Nancy Knowles, who disagrees.
I voted to remain because I work in local government and a lot of the hype about immigrants claiming benefits simply isn't true in this area particularly.
But job losses and austerity measures have hurt this town. Nancy didn't make her mind up to vote in until the very end.
The economy was going through my mind at the last minute. There's not much industry left in this town anymore.
A sad irony, because this town was once a powerhouse. While 18% of its people still work in manufacturing, that's a far drop from its heyday.
We came to fruition through the birth of the Industrial Revolution.
That's Ron Helsby, who runs World of Glass. It's a museum to the industry that used to dominate St. Helens and the countryside around it.
Everybody probably associates St. Helens with Pilkington's and the glass manufacturing, but that's only one story of the legacy that still remains within the town.
He walked me through exhibits dedicated to coal mining, pottery, medicine, and his organization's namesake, glass. The business that used to employ thousands of people on every shift. Today, Pilkington's is owned by a Japanese company. It still makes some parts in St. Helens, but automation and jobs moving elsewhere mean that a middle-class life of 30 years in the factories here is mostly gone.
My name is William Leyland, and I'm 73.
He had that life.
I voted leave, mainly because I don't like the way Europe have been telling us what to do.
He lost his last job in the glass industry when the factory he worked in closed. Like many here, he voted for the pro-Remain Labour Party his whole life, but soured on politicians for what he sees as giveaways to Europe and leaders who didn't look out for working people.
Governments at the time could have helped more. I mean, if you look at the Germans and the French, they propped their industries up. Ours just seemed to let them go.
I heard that frustration again and again, and it showed up in the Brexit vote. Here in the town square in St. Helens, the certificate of vote totals has been posted outside the council. The total number of votes cast was 93,721. To stay in the EU, 39,322. And the number of votes to leave the European Union, 54,357. I ended my day in St. Helens in, where else, a pub. It's called the Glass House, named for the town's main industry. And even before I joined their table, Keith Bromelow, Brian Burrows, and Rodney Bate were arguing about Brexit. Rodney and Brian voted in, and Keith was for out.
I'm a working man, and I don't see how Europe as it is helping the working man in this country. I've voted out, not for me personally, but for my children and grandchildren, to be honest.
I voted in for my children and grandchildren.
That was Brian chiming in to contradict him. And while they're laughing, just as long as someone buys the next round, what kind of Britain their grandchildren will see is really anyone's guess. I went back to the St. Helens Town Hall because I wanted to learn more about the economy here and why these voters, most of whom have been members of the Labour Party, which supported remaining in the EU, voted to leave. I found Mike Palin. He's the chief executive of the St. Helens Council, and he's also an economist. He's only 35, but since he's been in the job here, he's dealt with unemployment, budget cuts, and austerity measures. Here's Mike.
St. Helens was an industrial town, so if you walk up the stairs of our town hall, you'll see three stained glass panels. One shows metallurgy, one shows chemicals industry, one shows glassmaking. And we were a centre for those three industries, so companies like Pilkington's and Beecham's, global brands, came from this town. Those industries, along with coal mining, died in the 1980s into the 1990s. So around 20,000 people in glass lost their job. thousands in coal mining lost their job, yet St Helens has come through that period. Our unemployment rate is not too bad, and we've got very, very positive things going on in terms of the future economy in St Helens.
What's the unemployment rate?
The unemployment rate varies between 6 and 9%, so it's above the national average. We have a particular issue with youth unemployment, but that's common across all of Europe, but also in Northern England. So we do have issues around underemployment as well. So it's the people who are not employed full time is a particular concern.
And when you look at the big industries here, I know you all are interested in sort of making this a logistics centre. Where does the majority of employment break down?
So retail and wholesale is the biggest employer in St Helens, and that's common across many areas. We're still particularly strong in manufacturing. National average manufacturing employs around 11%. We're still up there in 17, 18%. Logistics is the big growth area. We expect in the next 6 months 3 million square foot of new logistics development within the borough to come forward for planning applications. The reason for that is that Liverpool has got a deep water berth that is just about to open. The Panama Canal opened just a few days ago. It means that Liverpool becomes the port of entry into Western Europe. And for a logistics operator, they want to be people and port centric. So if you come in 20 miles from the port, you can serve a population of 35 million people. So St Helens, we've got a great opportunity that we can grasp now.
You just said it would be the port of entry for Western Europe. Isn't that a big problem now?
And that's one of the concerns we've got. There's institutional investors, are they less likely to invest in the new developments that we were expecting over the months ahead? Have they got less confidence in the market? The UK is still a big market, so we would hope that these logistics operators that would have been serving the UK market would still want to come to St Helens because it's more economical for them to do so. But if they are part of the supply chains for big manufacturers, so Jaguar Land Rover employs 5,000 people not too far from here, what will their investment decisions be in the future? NSG is a Japanese company. It has two factories globally that produce a tiny spun glass cord, and every motor vehicle in Western Europe has that part manufactured here in St Helens in its tyres, because it's the only production facility outside of Japan that makes that part. It's a Japanese company, however, and if they don't have access to Western European car manufacturing markets, will they reconsider being located in St Helens? We have to wonder what those companies will do in the future.
Are you worried?
Not particularly worried, because we think that St Helens has got a bright future. What we are worried about is that there was European funding for programmes to get people into work. What happens to that funding? There's a complete lack of clarity over what will happen to that funding over the next 2 to 4 years.
This is a working class area. It's been a labour area. Why do you think they voted to leave?
I think there's an issue about people feeling left behind. So there's been a very strong narrative around the London and South East economy in the UK. That is the dominant economy in the UK. There's been a strong cities narrative for the last 5 years or so. But we sit in between two cities. So what has this narrative, this growth narrative, meant for a place like St Helens? That's not been articulated particularly well. Agglomeration does not mean everything goes into cities. It means that there are some things that can exist outside of cities, and maybe the narrative needs to change slightly, because you cannot have the 1 kilometre-long production line of Pilkingtons in a city centre, but you can have it in a place like St Helens.
So how do you then go out and rewrite that narrative and sort of assert a place for St Helens in a larger economy?
I think the first thing to say is we're a real place. St Helens is a real town. So we want to start selling ourselves more and talking about our strengths. So we want there to be more manufacturing here. Obviously, we've got to be debated now, but we know we've got industries that can come here, and we want to start talking ourselves up more.
Right now, how do you manage a place that is seemingly at so many fundamental odds?
We believe we're at a crossroads anyway. So we've done a lot of work within the council, and we're now sharing that with our partners to say we have to choose our own future. We have to be adaptive and innovative in what we do and control our own destiny. So we're very clear that we have a future, and that we're going to plan for that. And that's how you manage things. So we're not necessarily focused on tomorrow, but we're focused on 2025, 2033 and key years, 2033 being the year the High Speed 2 should come not too far from here. So we're planning ahead on that basis. In 5 years, we would like to have a sustainable health and social care system. That's one of the things that we'd want to have here. But as a place and as an economy, we'd like to be recognised as a sort of a growth pole between Manchester and Liverpool, with a strong manufacturing industry, strong logistics, but also arts and culture. We're investing heavily over the next few years in the arts and cultural sector.
Has austerity hurt St Helens?
It has. So this local authority has lost £73 million from its budget since 2010. By 2020, we'll have lost about £110 million from our annual budget. We've been through our cuts processes. We've trimmed away all the efficiencies, and we will have to look at discretionary services and see whether we can sustain them. So it has impacted on St Helens. But again, we're still a positive place. We still want to invest in our future, and we think we will still be here in that future.
That was Mike Palin, Chief Executive of the St Helens Council. From London, you're listening to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend in collaboration with our partners at the BBC. Here in the UK, the finance sector is massive. Over the past 40 years, the UK banking system has grown dramatically, total assets rising from about 100% of GDP in 1975 to 450% of GDP in 2013. That's according to the Bank of England. So what happens to those banks now? We've got Brian Kaplan, editor of the Banker magazine. Welcome.
Hi.
London passed New York as sort of the financial center in a big survey last year. Does that hold true next year?
Well, we're definitely facing a period of huge uncertainty. And the international banks and most of the city were definitely in favour of remaining within the European Union. So now it's obviously a question of taking stock and figuring out where we're going next. The key worry for the banks based in London is that they may lose something called passporting rights. So the passporting rights, it gives them access to the single market. So just by being in London within the EU, it means they can sell their financial services throughout the region. So clearly they're hoping that any deal going forward will include access to the single market. But then again, the problem with that is politically, because that involves free movement of people. So that's going to be a very difficult negotiation. On top of that, there's another smaller aspect, which is the fact that I think it's unlikely when the UK is outside of the EU that we'll be able to do one or two specific things, like, for example, having clearinghouses settled euro-denominated contracts in London. However, that is a business that, frankly, Frankfurt and Paris have been trying to grab back for many years anyway. So that's the uncertainty. Yeah. I mean, looking further ahead, you know, I mean, there could be opportunities from all this. So, I mean, we're developing an offshore Chinese renminbi business, for example. We're developing Islamic finance here. We could start to move those businesses on much faster. I'll give you an example of Switzerland has negotiated a tariff-free deal on financial services with China. So now the UK is free to do much more in that direction in terms of tapping into the growing demand for financial services from those big emerging markets.
But if passporting is a no-go, does that mean that, you know, your big financial centres will say, well, fine then, I'm going to Paris, I'm going to Frankfurt?
Well, I think it's more likely they would split their operations, okay? I mean, they could just have a brass plate office within the European Union. That would probably be enough to give them access. I mean, the Swiss don't have passporting rights, and that's what they do, or they actually use London. Or they could do something slightly more dramatic and restructure and move their, you know, the things that they need to sell into the European Union into Paris or Frankfurt, and then keep the rest of the business here. I mean, London has some long-term attractions as a financial centre. The rule of law and the legal system, the language, the time zone, the depth of the capital markets, the skill base, and actually, it's the ability to attract skilled people from all over the world which makes London attractive. So
maybe clearly, no longer?
Well, no, I think on the contrary. If, in fact, you know, what has been argued in the pro-leave campaign is, look, we could then start to have everybody we want purely on the basis of the skills and talents they offer the UK, whereas at the moment we're obliged to take anyone from the EU regardless of what they offer.
Brian Kaplan from The Banker magazine, thank you very much. If you want to learn more about the Brexit, what it means, how we got here, and what's next, visit our website, marketplace.org. We've also got you covered on Marketplace's Twitter and Instagram. Or if you want us to come to you, subscribe to our newsletters. You can do that by visiting marketplace.org as well. You're listening to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, coming to you from the BBC in London, where we're looking at the Brexit, the vote UK citizens took to leave the European Union. As we heard earlier, it sparked a lot of passion and discussion here in the UK, but it's also resonated with people in the US. Team Marketplace went out on the streets of New York, where people had a lot on their minds.
I was startled that it passed, and I was frightened.
Well, I don't know what to be afraid of. I am a little put on edge.
I'm honestly not totally sure how I would have voted if I was living in Britain.
I think it's disconcerting in the sense that you can feel the rise of populism.
I think it's unfortunate. I think people voted without really considering what the impact would be.
Initially, I did support Brexit. I feel like having independence for Britain from the European Union was an important thing.
I was shocked that they actually voted to leave the EU. I assumed it was kind of just something that was thrown out there and then people wouldn't actually go through with it.
For Sweden, my country, already has and might have direct consequences. And so it's a shame. We need more cooperation. We don't need to move away from each other. We need to stick together.
I don't feel like that much of a nationalist, so I'm concerned globally.
Personally, it concerns me on like a personal level in the sense that I kind of felt that Brexit leaving was similar to Trump being elected. I was like, surely no way it could happen. But apparently it can, so it kind of makes me very nervous for this November.
I'm concerned about the people in the UK. I'm concerned about consequences here. What's happening in the entire world is very, obviously, I feel it's troubling.
Even though the Brexit decision happened here in the UK, big economic moments still have a way of hitting home and affecting our personal finances. We asked you last week what questions you wanted answered when it came to the Brexit. Jill Schlesinger, a CBS News business analyst and a longtime friend of the show, is on to help wade through your questions. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
We're doing this transatlantic thing.
It's exciting.
I want to ask you one thing. I noticed a lot of brokerage houses and the kind of places that run 401ks essentially said first, don't panic, everybody. Is that sort of the note that we should keep in the back of our heads all the time?
Yes, although my mother tells me it's the most annoying thing and that when I say it on television, she makes me want to, like, she says to me, it's the worst thing to say. Of course I'm panicking. So maybe it's better to give you some sort of more useful tips instead of platitudes. And the useful tip is that if you are a long-term investor, you can kind of take a breath and say, wait. It's scary this moment, but I'm actually investing in my IRA or my 401k for 20, 30 years in the future. And even if I were 50 or 60 years old, chances are I don't have as much risk in my portfolio. And I'm still investing for decades in the future because you don't invest to a retirement date. You are investing as if you were trying to get yourself through retirement, which is now 30 years. So if you can kind of remind yourself of that notion, then you won't panic. It's a lot easier.
Well, then let's take some of these individual questions. I want to go ahead and play tape from a woman who called us named Janae.
Hi, my name is Janae Adams, and my question about Brexit is all about mortgage rates. How true is it that the mortgage rates are going to go down, and how well will people benefit, those that want to refinance and those who are trying to get into the housing market for the first time?
So I want to unpack this a little bit. She's talking about mortgage rates, and people might have a hard time making that connection. I suspect that she's going along the lines of, this is yet another potential shock to the global economy that is going to make the Federal Reserve hold off on raising rates.
And more to the point that when the world is in disarray, what many investors do is they pull money out of the stock market and they pour it into the bond market. And remember that the 10-year treasury is the most important factor in terms of determining a mortgage. And so if you looked at the past few days, mortgage rates did tick down. I mean, they were down already. But yeah, the one factor in terms of the first-time home buyer that's really been tough is that there just hasn't been a lot of inventory in the housing market. Mm. So rates have been cheap for a while. It's just, it's so disheartening if you talk to anyone looking for a house and they say, well, you know, we went to 14 open houses and got outbid on every single one. Now, the inventory problem is starting to ease up a little bit. So I am hopeful that we will get some more first-time home buyers in. The other really good piece of news around that is people are actually seeing their credit scores improve over the last few years. So that, too, has helped.
Well, we have another question about loans and about sort of the Brexit effect on those. Let's play this one. This is from Matt.
Hey, this is Matt from Miami. And one analysis that I've never been able to find is what's going to be the impact on LIBOR. I have a loan that's tied to LIBOR, an adjustable rate mortgage, and I don't know what the effect of the Brexit will be on the London Interbank Offer Rate.
So thankfully, Matt spelled out the acronym London Interbank Offer Rate. You want to explain what LIBOR is for mere mortals?
First of all, I agree that that was fabulous. So fantastic. Okay, so really what it means, it's a benchmark. When we say benchmark, it's sort of like the thing that we're basing other loans off of, okay? And when you look at LIBOR, it is the rate of interest that banks are lending money to one another in the wholesale market, and it actually happens in London. And once again, when rates generally are kind of going insane, especially with downward pressure on the yield and upward pressure on the price, everything's going down in tandem. But LIBOR is, generally speaking, a short-term rate. And so what that means is that, you know, it can look great for 5 days, but I can't tell you what it's going to be in 3 months. So I think that probably the answer is it's good because, generally speaking, when there's madness in the world, rates go down. That's kind of a good thing, but may not last.
May not last. These are pretty sophisticated questions we've gotten, by the way.
I'll say.
Yeah. Here's one more, and this is from Mike in North Carolina, and this, I think, is one for people who have, shall we say, an appetite for risk.
Hello, my name is Mike Cox, and I've had a few questions about the Brexit move. Yeah, I was thinking, what would be some good British companies to keep an eye on in the next 6 to 18 months that might turn into an eventual profit? Because my plan, if everything goes as it has been going, my prediction, you know, is to, you know, wait about another 8 to 12 months when the stocks on the British side are, you know, more over toward a bottom trend, and then wait another 3 or 4 years when they rebound from it, and of course turn a good profit.
Now, what Mike is talking about here is basically the sort of tenet of the stock market, which is, of course, buy low, but it's also something that most people don't do, which is wade into an uncertain and volatile situation like this one. What do you hear and think when you hear someone say, I want to know if I should buy stocks in the middle of a crisis?
The old trader in me says, I want to be on the other side of that trade.
Really?
And the because individuals who usually wade in do it at the wrong time and then panic when the trade goes against them, and then the other side makes money. Okay, we're talking a little bit about market timing, right? And generally speaking, it's very difficult to know when to buy and sell. That said, if you wanted to be like making a massive gutsy move right now, and you really said, I am not going to touch it, I'm going to pinky swear with you, Jill and Lizzie, that I really want to roll the dice. I think the stock area that will likely come under continued pressure. And it may not be, you know, in the for the foreseeable future, it's going to get better. But the UK banking sector just got shellacked. I mean, literally in the first 2 days after Brexit, the whole sector lost a quarter of its value in two trading sessions. If you were the type of person who wanted to say, well, I really don't believe that in the end these banks are going to go broke, and I really believe that 5 years from now that I would be better off, you know, sort of taking a risk on something and swing a little bit, that might be the area that I would do. But I'm going to do it with a couple of caveats. Number one, whatever money I would put into this investment, it would be money that I could lose. And so I'm not an individual stock picker, but, you know, if I'm going to take a flyer, it's going to be up to maybe 5% of my total portfolio value. Okay. Not my net worth, my total portfolio value. Yep. Okay. Next, if I'm going to really dip my toe in, I am going to be what's called a scale up buyer, which means that I'm not putting all the money that I have in this trade in this moment. I'm going to put a little bit of money in and see if it goes down another 10%. I put a little more in. But by and large, this is a very sophisticated question in many ways, and it's also kind of dopey in another way, which is like, what? Well, you know, frankly, you're better off just saying, stick to my game plan, get my stuff done. Why would I go here? What am I doing? Maybe I would rather go to Las Vegas and get some free drinks because it's similar odds that you're going to make money.
You know, one thing that struck me, I've been out doing reporting and I talked to a local government official in a town in the Midlands here in England. And he said, you know, it's very hard for them to plan right now, even as a small government, who they're going to do business with, because forget kind of the larger questions, but mid-sized businesses are trying to even figure out their financing. And that's up in the air right now with all of the chaos here. And I feel like if a business is having a hard time figuring out what it's going to do and a local government is having a hard time figuring out what it's going to do, maybe there's a message in there to individual people.
Considering that there's this huge vote and there's this whole campaign and the people who were advocating to leave the European Union have absolutely no idea the path they are going to take and, you know, which exit ramp is going to be for them, is kind of mind-blowing. It's like, well, I don't know, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. And all that uncertainty is not really good for any of us. I do think that there's something kind of unique about this crisis. And I'm not going to be a crazy Cassandra because I don't want to get hate mail from everybody. But just because you have two horrible days followed by two decent days in the market doesn't mean this is all over. I'm not saying that we're in a Lehman Brothers moment because everyone's very quick to say this is not Lehman Brothers and banks are better capitalized. I think that we would be really kind of ignoring history and trusting that everything's going to be okay is not actually the smartest move right now. We sort of trusted that the vote would go the other way and it didn't. So I think that it would be very wise for us to prepare ourselves for a very rocky time ahead.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Thank you, as always.
Great to be with you.
From London, you're listening to a special edition of Marketplace Weekend in collaboration with our partners at the BBC. The auto industry employs about 770,000 people in Britain. Last year, they built 1.6 million cars, and that industry relies heavily on Europe. The UK exports 77% of its cars. Of those, 57% go to Europe. So what happens now? Professor David Bailey is a car industry expert at Aston University in Birmingham, and he joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hello there.
You know, I was up in not too far from some of the car manufacturing areas where there used to be a big Vauxhall plant. And I guess I'm curious, the car industry is so reliant on Europe, and yet I feel that many of the workers in that area and that industry voted out. How do you square those things?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Certainly my own region here in the West Midlands, we trade a lot with Europe. The car industry is hugely important.
in terms of the economic makeup of the region, and yet it was one of the most Eurosceptic regions. So I think partly that's because the car manufacturers are often in formerly industrial areas. There's been, nevertheless, despite the success of the car industry, a longer run process of deindustrialization and people feeling excluded. So it's a car industry success surrounded by deindustrialization.
At the same time, you know, as we've seen the pound plunge, that actually makes UK exports a better deal in Europe. I mean, I guess there's a potential upside here for the auto industry?
Yes, there is. So in the short term, the depreciation in sterling, of course, makes exports cheaper. So we should see a boost to demand and therefore more production in the UK. Of course, it makes, as we were hearing earlier, imports more expensive. So the importation of components, which make up about 60% of the components going into cars in the UK, more expensive. So it pushes up the cost base. That plays out differently across different firms. So Jaguar Land Rover, which sources more components here, has higher margins to play with, is going to be less affected than Vauxhall, owned by General Motors, which brings in more components and has lower margins. So these will impact in different ways on different car companies.
What happens if we go back to WTO rules or WTO style rules? Will there be big tariffs?
I really hope that that doesn't happen, and that is the worst case scenario. If Article 50 begins, we've got a two-year period, as I understand, at the end of that. If a trade deal isn't done, we revert to WTO rules. That means import tariffs on components of just under 4% and on assembled cars of 10%. That isn't such a big deal in the premium market, but could be critical in the mass market. So this is a kind of a plea, I think, from the car industry we're hearing. Look, sort out that trade deal as soon as possible, because we can't go back to a situation whereby there are tariffs. It will have a big impact on the industry. Also, the longer that that uncertainty goes on about what the trading position will be with Europe, that will deter investment. If you are a major car producer, you're thinking about where to produce the next car in Europe. Are you going to put it into the UK, where there's considerable uncertainty over where sterling will be and considerable uncertainty over the future trading relationship between the UK and Europe? So we're likely to see investment being deterred. And that's a big issue. There's been £8 billion worth of investment in the car industry over the last 4 years. And we have to sort out a trade deal quickly so as to not deter that further.
Professor David Bailey at Aston University in Birmingham. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Come share your thoughts by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills, with special help this week from Levi Sharp, Marketplace foreign editor John Buckley, and BBC producers Rob Stevenson and Audrey Tinline. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday and Jeff Peters are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.